Session number 4816, Relate.
Mandamoran, relate.
Yes, my job was to start keeping records of not of what went on in Colditz, but official records, the sort of records that that the people at home would want when we got home. Because one of the points that was that prompted this was that various people had arrived in Colditz. I'm thinking, for example, of a chap named Moglia, who he was only one of many, who was very much of a mystery. We knew his story wasn't true, but at the same time we knew that he had very, very good reasons for telling us a story that wasn't true. We knew this, you know, he'd given us certain hints as to that. And as with everybody in that situation, our third degree squad had got hold of him and had really put him through it to get to the bottom of everything. And Moglia was always regarded with suspicion. Suspicion, yes, I suppose that's not too strong a word. Or he was regarded with doubt, or one wondered what lay behind it all. And in the event, this was all explained after the war, because soon after getting home, within a couple of weeks of getting home, I had a letter from Moglia from London. He'd been brought back to England with us, and I had a letter from Moglia, who was in effect Italian, and he asked me to get in touch with such and such a person at the War Office to establish his bona fides, to say yes, he was in Colditz, yes, he was a reasonable sort of chap, and to in fact give him a good character for the time he was in Colditz. And this I did. In fact, I've got Moglia's letter thanking me still in my files, saying how grateful he was because of this he was able to get back home to his family. And he explained that he was completely unable to give the true story while he was in Colditz. He didn't put this in his letter, but I saw him afterwards up in town. We had a meal and we had a drink together. But by doing so, he always had that fear that he was going to put other people at risk. He was very much an underground sort of chap, you see. So my job then was to get details of everybody in the camp. I had to find a hidey hole, first of all, which somebody else made for me to keep the record. I started a book, the camp roll, with details of everybody in the camp. Insofar as people who had come to the camp and had left before then, well, obviously the certain details I couldn't get. They weren't available to me. But I've still got that camp roll now. And this was hidden away. And they had these records had to be limited to the sort of information that we regarded as absolutely essential. We had to know who was in the camp. We had to know when they were kept. We had to have the details of chaps that could be checked up later on, and also details that would serve as verification when we got home. And a hell of a lot of those details were used for verification when we got home. So this was my one of my jobs. And also, somebody had, although this was all an upside down sort of business, we never really understood what lay behind it, but we used to get lager marks in Germany, camp money in Germany, so much a month. And we never really knew the story behind this, why we were getting it. We only knew this after the war, and it's only immediately after the war. You know, nobody was interested. All we were interested in was the feeling that with the war's over, we're home, you know, we're free again. But I was the chap who was appointed to look after the Lagergeld, to issue it out and to keep records of it and so on and so on. And this is this has proved very, very useful recently, because this money was paid to us in accordance with the Geneva Convention, the 1929 Geneva Convention, which Germany signed, and which laid down that the holding power would pay to officer prisoners, and officer prisoners, because non-officer prisoners could work and earn money, you see, and they were paid in token money, which they could spend, you know, they could buy all sorts of things with this. But officers couldn't work, they weren't allowed to. It was forbidden by the Geneva Convention, for the holding power couldn't make officers work, and of course if an officer felt he'd be a bloody sight better off working, which he would be, than sitting on his fanny doing nothing, well, he couldn't volunteer to do so, because he'd put himself immediately in the wrong position, you see. So I had to deal with the Lagergeld, and this has proved very, very useful recently in a controversy that arose some months ago, when an ex-RAF chap raised the question. It was raised in Parliament, and there'd been a lot of discussion about it, and we're still awaiting the outcome. This money that was deducted from our pay, was paid to us in Lagergeld, was also deducted from our pay at home, and it approximated to one third of our service pay. So it was my job to look after that. And although I haven't the original records that I kept, because as soon as I got home, I sent them to the various authorities, to the Army, Navy, Air Force pay authorities, to the Australian, New Zealand, Canadian authorities, and I still have their letters thanking me for them. But this is all building up now, has built up in the last few months, because I've been involved in this business of trying to reclaim the money that was deducted from our pay, because the Geneva Convention stated clearly that this money was to enable officers to buy food and perhaps a few additional necessities or luxuries. And the fact was that we couldn't buy food and we couldn't buy anything else. There was nothing to spend the Lagermarks on at all, absolutely nothing. Some of them were used for bribing, because the sentries, by whatever means, were at their disposal, some round, because there were ordinary prisoners of war working outside, and they had duties with them as well. They could convert these Lagermarks into real things, into whatever they wanted to buy, but they were no use to us, because there was sweet Fanny Adams to buy. All we ever spent them on were heavy fines, very heavy fines. You know, at any escape attempt, if any damage had been done, we were fined heavily, perhaps thousands of marks. And we paid for laundry and various other fines that were imposed on us, but insofar as using the money as it was envisaged and laid down in the Geneva Convention, no, there was just nothing, the money was useless, you see. But in this current situation that's going on now, I'm fortunate in as much as I've got the whole story. I was actually actively involved in that, because it was I who looked after the money in Colditz. And so I'm in a position, and which I have done, to contradict an awful lot of stuff that was said by Mr. Patey, the minister who dealt with these things. And now we're awaiting the outcome. But this was a job that kept me very, very fully occupied. So, now, I was very, very lucky with this job. A, it gave me something to do. It gave me an interest. Almost a full-time occupation. But at the same time, it meant that I could opt out of waving the flag, if you like to put it that way. I could opt out of these phony attempts at escape, the attempts that you knew were just a waste of bloody effort. You know, there might have been a lot of sweat and strain and getting damn tired and feeling frustrated, but you knew damn well that they were going to get you nowhere. You knew that. I mean, okay, there were a number of ideas that cropped up, and I was involved in one, two, three of them. that got nowhere, but there was the hope of them getting somewhere, even if only remote. But so many of them, there was not a chance in hell of them getting anywhere, you see. But at the same time, because you were where you were, you just had to show an interest. You had to be involved in something, you see. So I was lucky, because, you know, I could opt out of that, and nobody would say, right, I'm Mike Moran's happy sitting here, you see, because they knew that I got a job to do, you see. And of course the same applied to one or two others. The same applied to Dick Howe, of course, because he was escape officer, you see. So nobody expected Dick to be, you know, digging silly tunnels that would get nowhere, or to be trying to knock a wall down that would get you nowhere, or whatever it may be, you see. So I was very, very lucky indeed. Not only in that context at the time, but also since the war, because it's given me, well, I suppose that is the reason why now I am the dog's body, if you like to call it that, of the Colditz Association. Because, you know, I was the chap who kept all, I was one of the, when people think back on certain problems, on certain things they want to get solved, not so much now because it's a long time ago, but there was only one person they thought of, kind of, oh, Muggsy will know the answer to that, you see. So this has given me an awful lot since.
What was this third degree squad you mentioned?
Well, in the same way as because there were spies. You know, we had this question of spies and stool pigeons very much in the forefront of our mind. Now, I'll quote you a particular case. In fact, I only learnt the other day that Rebecca West, it's only a week ago perhaps, I learnt that Rebecca West had written a book just after the war. What's it called? Traitors is in the title. That she'd written a book, and one chapter is devoted to this particular chap. But in Marlag, there were one or two people, obviously, as there are in every camp, or were in every camp, who were the odd man out for one reason or another. One didn't like them, or one didn't trust them. Mm-hmm. And there was one such chap in Marlag. And I only learnt about the background to this afterwards, because before I left Marlag, very soon before I left Marlag, Appel was called one day, and there we were lined up, and there weren't many naval officer prisoners in those days. In fact, the total number, as I've heard recently, the total number at the end of the war of naval officer prisoners was about 400, which was, you know, infinitesimal compared with RAF and army people. But on this particular day at Marlag, we were lined up, and some senior German officers came in, accompanied by a number of civilians, including one Britisher, or one Englishman. And this Englishman was, I can't think of his name now, but he was very much in the news. We knew him before the war. Was he an actor or a playwright? And, of course, he was very much in the news immediately after the war. He was with them. And Marlag was, I suppose you might call it a soft camp. Certainly a very soft camp compared with Colditz, where conditions were, well, I suppose almost the conditions of a holiday camp compared with Colditz, inasmuch as there was plenty of room. We had our own gardens. We had tools to dig the gardens. We were provided with seeds that we could grow stuff there. We had a hut set aside as a university, and, you know, you had chaps who could take classes for almost everything. You had room to breathe there, so conditions weren't too bad. And at that time also, the Red Cross parcels were coming in, and the German rations were one hell of a lot better than they were later. Anyhow, we had this group there, complete with this Englishman, and this was it was a Dutch uncle session there. The commandant, of course, was there as well, but the commandant didn't address us, except initially to say whatever he said to the SBO. But the gist of this was their sympathy for our plight as prisoners. It's something that could happen to everybody. You're all honourable soldiers or honourable seamen or whatever it was, and we sympathise with you in being prisoners. We know that you're not to blame. We know that you did your duty and that you should be respected for that. And we know that you hate being prisoners. You know that the future is uncertain. We don't know how long the war is going on. We feel for you and being cooped up as prisoners and so on and so on and so on. You know, the soft approach. And we feel as Germans who want to be friendly with everybody, we feel that this isn't fair on you, and it's up to us to make your life a little easier than it is. You see, this was all that's a sort of general drift of the build-up, and we've decided that whereas soldiers on active service get leave from time to time, you people don't get leave. You're stuck here all the time, so we feel that you're just as much entitled to leave as anybody else. You see, this was, you know, more or less the gist of it. And they'd established a holiday village. I don't know where the hell this holiday village was, but they had established this holiday village where selected prisoners of war or groups of prisoners of war could go for a week, and there they would live as normal human beings. They'd get comfortable quarters, they'd be well fed, and there'd be entertainment laid on for them and so on. And broadly speaking, I'm sure that the reception was a chiacking reception. But a number of people fell for it. And I left Marlag just when this was happening. I was deeply involved with other things at the time. My particular team at the time, we were digging this long tunnel of ours, and you know, this was our life. This was what we did all day, and what we dreamt about at night was progressing this tunnel and getting out of it and getting home. So, you know, in any case, we weren't interested. It was something that there was no concern of ours, you know, so we couldn't be involved in any way whatsoever. We just weren't interested. So, you know, I don't suppose we really formed a decision, because it was as if we'd been excluded from it right from the start, because we were so deeply involved in this tunnel of ours. But I remember then, in talks about it afterwards, and some chap saying, well, you know, this sounds fine, why the hell not? And, you know, I sympathised with the approach of some of the chaps that said, well, what the bloody hell have we got to lose, you know? And if they try anything else when we're there, well, we can always say no, you see. And, of course, this is what it was all about. Fine. The approach was a welfare approach, but when they got there, and we didn't learn this until one hell of a lot later, once they got there, fine, they got everything that was promised. Not only their comfortable quarters and good food and entertainment, but also pretty little fillies laid on, you know, take your choice, chum. Everything laid on, you see. And why the hell not? Because there weren't many pretty little fillies floating around in POW camps. Fine. I'd left Marlag before this was put into operation, before anybody had actually gone away. But some 2 years or more later, lo and behold, we knew one chap, and this is a chap I'm talking about, a chap who was mistrusted and wasn't liked, who put his name down for this. And some 2 years or more later, who should walk into the courtyard in Colditz, accompanied by a couple of sentries, but this very chap. And by then we'd got, how many? It must have been built up to about 15 RN and RM chaps in Colditz, chaps who had been in Marlag and who knew this chap. And the first reaction was, what the bloody hell's he doing here? You know, you couldn't believe it. Certain chaps, you saw them walking in, you'd say, God, there's old so-and-so, and you'd rush up and welcome him, and you know, it'd be delightful to see him again. But the reaction there was, what the hell's this chap doing here? And you just couldn't understand it. So immediately we contacted our investigation squad. And this was in the same way as we had them in England. You know, if somebody suspected of being a spy was caught in England during the war, he went through the third degree, and we had our own squad here, you know, chaps who could really, really put him through a pretty grueling time. And they had this chap for hour after hour after hour, and they got the story from him in the end. And he'd taken part in this, he'd gone to this holiday village, and he'd fallen for whatever happened while he was there. And I suppose it was thrown at them again, you know, do you want to go back to a prisoner of war camp? You know, you're not betraying your country if you get whatever benefits you can out of being a prisoner of war. You've got the choice of either going back to your prisoner of war camp and languishing there, or you can do this. And whatever lay beyond it, I don't know. I don't know the details of what this chap did. But in the end, he found himself in Berlin. He got a comfortable apartment in Berlin. He got a living-in girlfriend, and he was broadcasting on the German radio. And he told us this. You know, our chaps got it out of him, and you know, we got some pretty good chaps in Colditz. You know, they weren't a lot of innocent boys who were questioning him. They were chaps who knew what they were bloody well doing. And what we got from this chap, having got the story out of him, was that he'd seen the error of his ways, and he told the Germans, well, you know, what I've done is wrong, but it finishes here and now. And that's why he was sent to Colditz. And this possibly is true. But we felt very, very strongly indeed, at least our interrogation squad did, and we Navy chaps who knew him also felt precisely the same, that he'd been sent to Colditz as a stool pigeon, that he was still collaborating, and he was sent there as an informer. So we put him under close guard and informed the SBO. In fact, the SBO was informed during the interrogation. When things had got to a certain point, he was informed, and he asked for an interview with the commandant, and told the commandant that if this chap wasn't removed from the camp within the next couple of hours, we would not be responsible for his safety. And he was removed from the camp. And we know he was put into cells, but again, we assumed that this was, and because we knew he was put into cells, and he could have been put into cells without us knowing, but we knew that he was put into cells. You know, this was, our viewpoint was that this information was fed to us so that to confirm the chap's story, that he had changed his mind, that he was a new character. But and then he was sent away from the camp, from Colditz, and I heard no more. We wondered, of course, and I heard no more about this until sometime in 1945. I forget what I was doing at the time, what time in 1945 it was. I think it was before I went back to sea, because I didn't go back to sea until about August 1945. So I was probably, it was probably whilst I was doing a refresher course. I had a letter from MI5 or MI4, whichever it was, but from one of the intelligence departments in London, saying that this chap was going to be put on trial, and they wanted me to appear as a witness at the trial. And this gave me a very, very difficult time indeed, a very difficult time, because I've got very strong views about one or two, and I had those same strong views then. And one of these strong views, very strongly held views, was that in a case like that, or any similar sort of case, nobody who hasn't been subjected to the same conditions and the same temptations as the chaps they're going to try, is in a position to try them. You know, I felt that very, very strongly. And I felt that, you know, I really wasn't in a position to give evidence against this chap, because, you know, one always doubts oneself. One never knows what one is going to do oneself in certain circumstances. You just don't. I remember when war broke out, discussing with chums of mine, what should we do under certain circumstances? How will we react under certain circumstances? You know, you find yourself face to face with great danger. How are you going to react? You just don't know how you're going to react. You know, it's impossible to say. You don't know whether you're going to pull your shoulders back and say to hell with you, or whether you'll be cringing in terror. You just do not know until this situation occurs, you see. So I wasn't prepared. I wasn't prepared to give evidence, to appear and do my part in convicting this chap, because, you know, I knew the temptations, and I knew that it's so easy for anyone to react in the way that this chap did react. And so I was excused. I was very firm about it, that I just couldn't do so, and I was excused. And this chap was sentenced to a very long term of imprisonment. I think that's what it was, a long term of imprisonment. But I've ordered this book of Rebecca West's, and although it was published one hell of a long time ago, I think in 1946 it was published, and the chances of getting a copy are rather remote. Nevertheless, I'm hoping very much to do so.
So the holiday camp of the Germans was really to secure collaboration from the POWs?
Oh, yes, indeed. I can't think for one moment that it was intended for the benefit of the POWs.
I wonder if you can tell me the circumstances under which you came to be liberated.
Yes, indeed. Well, we had our own radio. We'd had our own radio for quite a long time, and this is quite a story in itself. But suffice to say that the radio belonged to the French. They got it in, and this was a very, very elaborate business of A, having keys to this place and that's, and having codes going between the French prisoners. It was we had codes going between the French prisoners and their people at home, and knowing that certain goods were going to be sent to the particular individuals, knowing what the parcel would look like. And we had access, because of keys we'd made and explorations that had been made, into what was called the parcels room, where the parcels used to come. And this was leading off the courtyard with big heavy doors. So when the contraband parcel was due, the French knew precisely what it was all about, and they were able to substitute a parcel in its place. They were able to get in and substitute a parcel in its place. The Germans knew there was something fishy going on, because they changed all the electrics and they installed various trick devices there, but we had chaps who could overcome those. Anyhow, that's roughly the background behind getting a radio. And when the French left, the French were all cleared out. These were the 1940 French. In September or August 1943, they left us their radio. So we used to get the BBC. We built this into one of the walls, and some of these walls were about 12 feet thick. We built this into one of these walls, and we used to get the BBC News virtually every day.